6 o'clock, I'm going to call the meeting to order. I did do a roll call. We have myself, Laura Belsky, Andy Berg, Sandra Beth, David Salivary, Aaron Decker's excused, Jerry Gully, and Kim Lewis. Kathy, are there any citizen comments?
None.
None submitted?
Mr. Chairman, okay. Can we recognize youth and governance? Oh, sorry.
First of all, I'd like to say it's really wonderful to see you all in person. It's really nice. So I'm glad, well, except maybe Supervisor Gully. But it's really nice to see all of you and spend this time together. I would like to recognize, is Armin here? No. I would like to recognize Armin Harris. He received a Boys and Girls Club of Kenosha full tuition scholarship to Carthage College. So great job for Armin. And Millie, it was a beautiful picture in Kenosha News in Today's Teen on May 1st. Congratulations.
Oh, yay.
Supervisor Gully, did you have anything else that you wanted to mention?
Nice meant for as far as attendance.
Oh.
They were here, that's all.
Okay, we do have for attendance, Armin is not here this evening, but Millie is here. Mm-hmm. Okay, approval of the minutes of April 5th. Is there a motion?
We'll move. Second.
Supervisor Gully first and Supervisor Berg seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Let's move on to resolution to appoint Sharon Palmaville to the Human Services Board.
Thank you, Chairman Belsky. I'll take that. Sharon Palmaville is here if anyone has any questions, but she would be filling one of the vacant county board supervisor positions that we have for the Human Services Board, and I'd ask that this committee move that appointment forward. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, is there a motion?
Motion to approve.
Supervisor Berg motion to approve, second by Supervisor Salivary. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Welcome aboard. Now we have the resolution supporting LGBTQA Pride Month. Supervisor Zach.
Thank
Rodriguez.
Thank you, Chairwoman Belsky. I want to start off by saying I do have some printed out copies here, but I wanted to address something that was brought to my attention after this resolution was put out there for the public to take a look at. There was a concern that those who practice various faiths may not be able to support this resolution, or they were concerned with certain wording in the resolution. So I did come up with a compromise that I'd be happy to pass around. Just changed a few words. I will start with whether this committee decides to take these compromises or not is at the sole discretion of the committee members. But I would support it either way. But in a nutshell, I reworded where we found support to recognize. Like I said, I did have various community members reach out saying that because of their faith, they, you know, didn't feel it was appropriate for them to use the word support. I explained to these community members that I understand where they're coming from. As a man of faith myself, I don't share those same beliefs. I am very open and very supportive of the LGBT plus community. But I'm going to pass these around nonetheless so you guys can take a look at them. And then I guess I'll just pass this way until they get all the way around. So.
So Supervisor Rodriguez, are you striking paragraphs and adding?
No, the only things that would change were is if you guys are on your iPads, if you see instances where it says supports, now, the, here you go, Supervisor. It would now say recognizes. One example would be, you know, the title, it would, instead of a resolution supporting, it would be a resolution recognizing. Again, this is up to the sole discretion of the committee. I tried to cater as much as I could to everybody in the community, but I thought this was important for us to undertake because this is something that the county board's never recognized in the past. I'm not sure if the county executive has or not. I didn't look into that, but I know, and this will be my third year on the county board, something like this has never come before us, and to my knowledge, you know, previous boards haven't recognized this in the past either, but it's something important. It's something that we saw previously, recognition amongst our own members. We see it even today on the county board, and it's a snapshot at what life in Kenosha looks like and who we are and that we're proud of who calls Kenosha home. So there's three pages, just because I don't like back-to-back. So well, we get this situated, like I said, the title of it changed, and then the third whereas, it now reads whereas recognizing Pride Month raises awareness instead of whereas supporting Pride Month. Another one off the top of my head, because I don't have the original in front of me, my iPad's off, but I believe it's the fifth, I believe that also said we must commit to, or that one I didn't change, accepting. I think that's important. I think we should commit to accepting the members of this community. The following whereas didn't change. I don't think the following two. And then now, therefore, be it resolved, the Kenosha County Board of Supervisors recognizes the month of 2021 as LGBTQ+, and then parentheses, as it's commonly known, Pride Month, and we urge all residents to build a culture of inclusiveness and acceptance during this month and every month. So I'm not sure if anybody has any questions, or like I said, the committee might choose to just go back to the original. But I tried to cater as much as I could, so.
So we would need a motion to amend the current resolution.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Or I'm not sure if there could be a motion to substitute, maybe even, because the title of this one changed, so it is different because
okay.
The title changed. I'm not sure. I would defer to one of my colleagues who's been on the board longer than I have. So. And did everybody get one? Because I have an extra copy.
I'll give everybody a moment
okay.
to look
yeah,
through it. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
So, through the chair to Supervisor Rodriguez, it looks like, unless I'm missing it, so pretty much instead of the word support on the original, you've changed it to recognizing in the title and other places. But it looks as if I'm reading it correctly, it looks as if the intent is basically the same.
Correct.
And that, so, yeah, I would say, speaking for my people, we approve your changes to the resolution. So I'll make that motion.
I appreciate that.
So that would be motion to replace or substitute.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I found three instances, I believe, where that word has been changed, and I do not believe there's another change unless I'm missing it.
And since Supervisor Gulley supports the verbiage for his people, I will second that.
Okay, I want to make sure that Kathy gets the correct language. So,
and I can give her this. I have a copy of it. I can give it to her.
Okay, so we are substituting a resolution in support of LGBTQ plus A plus Pride Month with a resolution recognizing LGBTQA plus Pride Month, and any association with supported will, has been now changed to recognizing. We have a motion by Supervisor Gully, a second by Supervisor Burke. All in favor?
If I may,
yes.
Madam Chair, again, or just a housekeeping, I don't know if the hard copy that you originally have has the correct committee on it, because as we originally discussed, we thought this might go to legislative, but mm-hmm. I did print out a corrective version for the committee, and then I want to affirm again my support for the community and my commitment to making sure that Kenosha County is somewhere that those who are members of the LGBTQA plus community can call home. And I will do everything in my power to make sure that we strive to continue that mission every day. So thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee.
And I wholeheartedly support this. I said I would actually sign on to it, but that's okay.
I thought your name might, but I wasn't sure. So again, and that's also something I can bring up at the next county board meeting too. If anybody's interested in adding their name, we'd be happy to have your name
added. Yes, I would love my name added. So we have a first and a second. All in favor to substitute the original resolution?
Aye.
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 Is there any opposed? Resolution passes. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, you could pass that one around.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Youth and Governance, how do you vote?
Aye.
Wonderful. Thank you, and I'm sorry for keeping you off of the first one. It's our first time all back together. Now we have vaccine clinic updates by Dr. Jen Freiheit.
Thank you, Chairman Belsky, and all members. I have a vaccine update for you as far as what we are planning moving forward. Our Shopko clinics have been wildly successful. However, the numbers are greatly decreasing. We are lucky on any given day to get anywhere between 50 and 100 walk-ins, which is a very low number, especially at such a big facility where it takes many resources to run that. So we are shifting our strategy to be much more mobile out in the community, to be able to go to workplaces, churches. We're even stopping into payday loan stores and gas stations. So wherever we can meet people where they are at is really the strategy moving forward. It has been for the last month, and then moving forward through August, and we'll reassess and see where we are in August. So as far as moving forward with the Shopko Mass Clinic, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 more clinics there that are half-day clinics, and we have one out at Central Westosha that's a full day next Wednesday. And so really those are the last of our big mass clinics. Of course, if anybody after that wants a COVID shot, we will offer them through our nurse of the day NOD clinic, which is right down the hall, and at our wellness center clinic, which is above the WIC office in Uptown. And we will continue filling any requests for mobile missions. So we're getting requests to present at different events and festivals and that sort of thing. So we're fulfilling all of those as we move forward. And of course, then we'll have a couple extra clinics here at the job center to finish out second doses as well. And that is our vaccine update. We will continue to work hard on it.
Dr. Freiheit, so does that mean that Shopko will shut down?
It will no longer be an active site. If we need to go back to that, we could. The lease goes through August, so we will still have capacity to be back there if we need to. I am hoping that the 12 to 15-year-olds get approved this week, so they will still be able to come into our clinics as we have them for the rest of this month. Although we are concerned and we need help to get the push out there, because even with our 16 and 17-year-olds, we're only at 26% with one dose of that age group. So we definitely need to get the children vaccinated.
Okay. And then with regard to Kickstart events, do we have an update?
Yes, thank you. So we have been receiving many, many phone calls and emails with plans for everybody from the Harbor Market and Public Market to the Recplex, Country Thunder, Bristol Renaissance Fair, Kenosha County Racing, Wilmot Flea Market, several. We have received several requests to help work through their events. Some of them are changing from, let's say, a banquet or a dinner to not having food, or they're altering their ingress and egress, or doing things whereby they can spread people out and be safer. So we are doing a couple of site visits for people who would like us, for example, church festivals, to walk through their grounds and figure out a different layout than they ever had before. Otherwise, we're doing a lot of phone calls, answering questions, and then as people work with their own boards and they're setting up their plans, they are then calling back to have us look at those. So we definitely are providing that service, and lots of people calling, and we're helping answer their questions.
Wonderful. Does anybody have any questions? Supervisor Burke?
Yes, in terms of the different locations that you're going to kind of like pop up places, do you have an idea of where those places are, or you're just going to kind of go off the cuff, or...
For our pop-up vaccination clinics?
Right.
So we are fulfilling any requests. This week, for example, we're doing some Carthage students tomorrow. We're going to Iris USA on Thursday. So when they fill, we have a form request that I think I sent out last Tuesday with the SIT rep. So people are filling out requests. We're fulfilling them 100% at this point because we have the resources to be able to do that. And then as people are requesting just for events or whatnot, or to go to their churches. So the process is where they're starting a request form, we will assess the site, so we might determine that, oh, this is just a two-person job, or we need to bring 10 people, depending upon the number of projected vaccines, and then really just setting it up logistically to be able to meet their needs.
So it's more or less a planned situation where somebody says, hey, we want you to come here, we've got X amount of people. So it's not really, is it going to be open to the public to come to these, or do you still want them coming here?
So it could go both ways. So if it's, let's say, you know, we set up at a farmer's market or at an event, then it's open to anybody to walk up. If it's at Iris USA, they have 30 employees that they know want to get vaccinated, and they've already scheduled them during the time slot we're there. So it's and both.
So in terms of public places then, is it possible for you to send an email out to supervisors so that we can, if it happens to be in our district or
absolutely.
You know, something that we can push out to our constituents or the public versus, you know, not knowing about it? Yeah, I understand a workplace like Irish, yeah, you're not going to send
right.
constituents that don't work there to there. I get that.
Absolutely. No, we'll definitely do that. And then if you know of any workplaces in you know, your jurisdiction as well, too, that you know, you're reaching out to, or any events or whatever, please do advocate, and we'll make it happen.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Supervisor Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question about some of our major employers. Have any of the major employers in Kenosha County reached out to do this? Amazon, AWG, Uline, et cetera, for Kenosha County to come in and you know, vaccinate their employees?
We actually reached out to all of them first and offered our services. Uline ended up making an arrangement with Freighter South. Amazon made an arrangement just this week. They finished up yesterday with Walgreens. And we've been going into workplaces too, so we're still sort of reaching out to the workplaces that we know are larger or that and smaller, and those who had outbreaks, let's say, over the last year. So some of them are being taken care of by others. We've had workplaces who were taken care of. For example, we have workplaces that gotten taken care of by Lake County Health Department, but they have stragglers, so then we're going out and taking care of those to get vaccinated afterward.
Any other questions? Thank you, Dr. Frey.
Really
appreciate it. Next up, we have a DCFS fiscal placement report by Ron Rogers and Tammy Capito.
Thank you.
Hi there. Thank you, Chairman Belsky. So the document that you guys have received is where we are so far in the DCFS placements. What I'm going to point out is this is our annual budget this year. It's $10,076,520. When we take that and we divide that to figure out how much we should be through March 31st, we should be at $2,484,000. Right now, with expenses and placements, we are at $2,576,540. And if we continue at this rate with these many placements, we would be at $10,449,301, which give us an over budget of $372,783. I'm just going to scroll up to the top here. So this whole graph shows you by placement type here. So here you'll see what the different placements are. And this is how many we had projected and budgeted into our placements for 2021. These are the rates that we were running when we did the budget and where we were at. And then that's how we came up with our budget amount. So when we come over here, what we're doing is we're dividing it, our shortfall between placements and by the rate. So in the first bucket, regular foster care, our placements are down 27.3, which equates to almost 60,000, and our rate is down to 28, which equates to 36,000. So for this line item here, we actually have a credit. We're running a credit through March 31st. But then as you see, as you go down, and I'm not gonna go through every one, but each one is different as to what the rate is causing for our forecast and what the days is causing and what the forecast is causing. So we get down all the way to the bottom here. That gives us our rate over here. So here's our number of kids in care. We have actually a savings of 232,000, but then our rates for through March 31st, we actually have an overage of 324,000. And then that just brings it down here. And then when we are 91,000 over budget through March 31st. When we straight line that out, we're up to 372,000 is what we're expecting. This obviously could change. We could have more kids in care. In future months, we could have lower rates, lower costs, you know, maybe less COVID costs. It fluctuates, but that's where we're at as of March 31st. Any questions on this graph?
Tammy, does that include the cost for the child in New Jersey? Is that what's putting us over?
Yes. That's in there.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It does. Absolutely. Yeah. So if I can, so I'll add to that. Or just like. Okay, thank you. All right, thanks, Tammy. So yeah, I mean, if you look at a couple of these lines, it helps explain. So if you look, using that kid is in what they call a residential care center. I apologize, I'm not using the mic. So we budgeted for 11 kids to be, and that means not 11 kids. It means the average census will have 11 kids throughout the year in that type of placement setting. And we really, we're below that as of March. We have 10.4, but you can see the rate, the daily rate of 644. That one child is, he isn't the only cost of that rate going up, but he's the majority of that cost. Yeah, when I punched in the numbers. And so the good news, I mean, when you look at all of this as far as kids, and I focus on kids, and we'll talk more about how kids come into care, but we are getting kids out of foster care home safely, and that's why this number has dropped. We, if you remember, the county board voted to support Project Permanency, where we're moving kids who aren't going to get home safely through the TPR process more quickly, and that you see that, you can see that movement here in less kids in foster care. We've also seen less kids in treatment foster care, which is, again, about an average sense right now of less than 10. And those are kids also, mostly those are child welfare kids in foster care and treatment foster care, meaning kids that have been abused and neglected.
What we found, though, is we've had higher rates than we expected in our residential care center, and that's where she pulls all this together, is the variance in the rates, and that the rates are higher in a number of areas. So although we have less kids in treatment foster care, the rate the treatment foster care agencies are charging us is up higher, so those almost cancel each other out. We have less kids in that setting, but the ones that are there are being charged a higher rate. Yeah. Any questions about that?
Supervisor Gulley.
So the care types that are that we underestimated, so I'm looking at treatment foster care, looks like it's about 34% up. Shelter care, about 34%, and then residential care looks like it's 26 or something. Is that being, are those like industry numbers that are just higher than we expected, or are those numbers affected by specific cases that are ramping up, or both?
More of the second. So like in the residential care center, anytime a kid has gone out of state, they charge a much higher rate. When we did the budget back in October, we had, I think, four or five kids out of state. Right now, we have two, and one is that very expensive child that is bringing up everybody. Yeah. And there's one other child in Arkansas. Yeah. And then and in treatment foster care, the state sets the formula to how you reimburse treatment foster care, and it's a mixture of more kids with more significant needs than we thought driving the cost of that care up. So there's a formula, you measure their needs, it's an assessment criteria, and that adds to the rate. Yeah.
The great news is that you've gotten, you've got 10% less kids
right
in the system, which is great, but unfortunately, it's predominantly in the lowest cost
yes
category.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So your estimate, your projection for the variance in the budget is hopefully best case scenario. Meaning that if you were to see, if you had two or three placements in the more expensive, that could increase that somewhat dramatically, right?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not asking you to, obviously if you project it, you would project it, you would know, but.
No. So yes, if we have more kids go into higher levels of care. So the highest cost levels of care are residential care centers and corrections would be the two that are
right.
Very expensive. And when you can see they're almost identical in cost, 510 and 535. So yes, if you have a lot more kids going into either setting, they are the equivalent of, an extra 40 kids going into foster care, probably. Yeah. So, and I also have for this presentation tonight, I also pulled together a PowerPoint just to help explain why kids come into out-of-home care and how they get there. So if you're comfortable with, if there's more questions about the numbers, I'm happy to answer those, or I can move to that as well.
I have one more question.
Sure.
Do you see the numbers down because of COVID, the numbers and the costs?
That's a great question. So no, yes and no. I think Project Permanency has been very successful. We've moved a bunch of kids. We had a lower number of cases come in 2020 in the child welfare system than we did in the year before, is significantly. So we had less kids entering foster care. That, I don't think, has made a big impact in the number of kids that have significant treatment needs that need residential care, for example. And it didn't, our numbers of delinquent youth has dropped a little bit, but not nearly as significantly as the child welfare kids. But it is now January, February, March, April. We have done many more investigations of child abuse in the first 3 months, actually in through April, through the first 4 months of the year. We're averaging a good 15% higher than a normal year right now. So I feel there's like a pent-up, you know, kids weren't seen by mandated reporters. They weren't in school. A lot of parents held kids back from doctor's visits because of fear of catching COVID. Kids weren't at the Boys and Girls Club, other settings, sports, all of that. So those are the adults that call in allegations of abuse and neglect. So our calls dropped in 2020. It is almost like a light switch. After the holidays in January, our calls have increased dramatically. And January, February, March, and April.
So this year, the program kicked off this year, which is great. So we'll have to let it get through a whole nother year to actually see the actual results, right?
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
And then did we have I can't recall if we had a plan or if there was a strategy for this child that's in New Jersey. Wasn't there going to be some?
Oh, yeah. There's where I've been treatment meetings about him every other month or every month. He's actually made progress, and he's making progress in his treatment. And we're working, hopefully, on the next step of I can't promise transition in a month, but there's progress. You know, he's a very disabled young man. I mean, it's extremely disabled. He can't do what I'm doing now. He can't talk to you. He communicates through an adaptive communication device. He's developmentally delayed with autism, so he has significant needs. Yeah.
If you could just keep us updated to how he's doing and
sure.
And the progress that he's making, I would appreciate that.
Yeah, we made there was a significant breakthrough with this young man, teenager, in April. They had really got him to finally understand the adaptive communication device, which is almost like a large iPad where you use pictures, and they had to reprogram it a bunch of times. It was still too complicated for him, and they suddenly realized they're having better communication with him. His aggressive behaviors reduced, and he's making more progress, making his needs known in a non-aggressive, non-combative style, which is all good, which
great.
Is really good.
Does anybody else have any other questions for the financial portion of the presentation?
Yeah, so we'll get will we get mid-year actuals before? I think last year we looked at that when we were in budget cycle. Will that kind of
yes.
We get it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry. I asked when we would see mid-year actuals and if that would happen during the budget cycle, which I believe that's when we saw mid-year actuals last year, or if it would be earlier, and I believe the answer was it will probably be in budget cycle.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. Okay, so I had a request by, let me just boot this up real quickly. So if there's any other questions about the dollars, I'm happy to go back to that if you'd like to ask more. But Supervisor Genson, the Finance Administration Committee, asked me to sort of to go over just sort of in a broad brush, real broad category, how do kids end up in out-of-home care? And we thought it would be good that I present that also to this committee. And I'll be presenting this to the Finance Administration Committee next week as well. So really, I divided this presentation into two parts: child welfare children, which are children that we're investigating for abuse and neglect, and those families, and then the next group would be youth justice youth. So those are the kids that maybe commit a crime in the community. So I'll make this brief, but and I won't read every word for you, but I'll just give you the overview. So we get an allegation that children are being abused. We get allegations from all over the community, but our primary focus are kids that are being abused at home, okay? It meets statutory guidelines that it can be screened in. We're not allowed to go out and investigate anything. There has to have certain criteria for it. We assign a county social worker. They often work with law enforcement. They may use the Child Advocacy Center, and they start an investigation. And that's a very thorough, deep dive into a family's life. We can contact school officials without getting permission. We can call medical providers, doctors, anyone. We can talk to neighbors, family, friends. But we're trying to assess, has any child been harmed? And we're also assessing, are the kids safe? So we're interviewing every child in the home if they're verbal. We're seeing every child in the home. We're interviewing every adult in the home. And we're also making collateral contacts. During that process, and it might be on the first day we go out there, it might be a week into that process, something happens where we've determined the kids are not safe in the home. There are safety threats present. We do have services that we can provide to go into the home to pull together a safety plan to try to keep those kids remaining with their families with an in-home safety plan. But if that's not going to work in our professional judgment, we contact juvenile court intake services. We request a temporary physical custody order for all the children in the home that are vulnerable children. They hear the facts, they grant that. That gives us the legal authority to place kids into out-of-home care. And that's how kids start in the foster care system. It's often in an emergency basis like that. It literally is, you walk into a situation and you go, these kids can't stay here. This is really dangerous. Okay? And we find foster homes or relative homes for those kids that day on the spot. Hopefully quickly, it could take a few hours. That then starts the court process, and what I really wanted to let everyone know is that at this time, we're in intake court. Intake court reviews everything we've done up to that point. They issue a temporary physical custody order. They are saying, yes, this is legal. We have the legal authority to do this. We're continuing our investigation, which we call an initial assessment. We start to offer some services to the parents. Often at this stage, the parents refuse. They are not ready to start working on anything, but we offer. And then we get visits going with the parents with their kids. Yeah.
Thank you. So if there's an instance where it's, at your first home visit or, shortly thereafter, you and your team have decided the children are not safe in this setting, they need to come out, does that go then, that's going through the circuit court system, either with a commissioner or a judge?
Correct.
So is that, I'm just trying to equate it for my understanding, would that be similar to the sheriff's department, for example, looking for a search warrant? Is there a judge that essentially acts on standby where if at a moment's notice your team needs to pull children out of a home, they grant it to the commissioner?
That's a great question. So we contact juvenile court intake services. They have people on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They issue this emergency temporary physical custody order. We then, on the next business day that the courts are open, we're in front of a court commissioner.
Okay.
Who then is reviewing everything that happened, like on Friday night or Saturday or the night before, and is saying, yes, this is legal, yes, this temporary physical custody order is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And then what happens here is then after that, all of our work is checked through the court process. So the court follows what Wisconsin statute chapter 48 called the Children's Code, and parents get public defenders, the county social worker, the assistant district attorney. Younger children get guardians ad litem. Older children get a public defender. Foster parents can attend these hearings. And there are numerous hearings at this part of the process because they have the DA is filing a petition saying these kids need protection or services. And the court is hearing any objections to that. Often parents are objecting, right, or their attorneys are objecting for them. And then during that, we're still working with all parties, and these kids are in care. What finally happens after multiple court hearings is the court will eventually issue an order saying that these children were found to be in need of protection or services, and they're found to have been abused or neglected, and there's certain exact statutory language for that. And they ordered the kids in foster care until age 18. They don't, it isn't just a year order. They are ordered into foster care until age 18 or 19. That is a, and I'll explain why they do that in a minute, but I can answer your question now, Supervisor Rodriguez, if you'd. Okay, okay. So what they do then is, at that point, the case has been transferred. Another worker, the long-term worker for the case, is involved now. He has taken the initial assessment, the investigation, or she. They have met the parents. They are trying to get a big social history. And they're trying to really get down to the facts of why, what is the underlying issue that makes this home unsafe? Meaning, are there underlying needs like addiction, mental health, untreated mental health, extreme anger issues, domestic violence, other things that are really be underneath all of the conditions that make the home unsafe. The order, the court then orders the parents to complete the service recommendations that we make. They put this under an umbrella term, conditions of return, and the court also warns the parents that there's that their rights could be terminated, and they may never get their kids back if they don't make changes to have a safe home for their children. So what happens then is there's just, and I won't read all of these, this slide, think of this slide as like a year or a year and a half of work. Meaning there's all these services brought to bear for the parents and for the children to improve the well-being of parents and children in the home. Yeah, Supervisor Berg?
Yeah, before you get into this one, on the last slide when you were talking about the children being in court with the public defenders and the parents are issued a possibility of termination of parents' rights and warning. During that time period, who tracks truancy of the student or of the child in schools? Is that something that's tracked?
Yes, most kids, if these are kids that are in the child welfare system, so they're victims of abuse and neglect, so there's a lot of these kids are really young, so they may not be in school age yet, like they're daycare age kids. Kids that are in like grade school, if they're in foster care, the foster parents are going to be getting those kids back in school.
So who tracks that? Did they just...
The county social worker will be talking with the foster parents.
Did they talk to the school at all or no?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of...
But the county social worker is going to talk to the foster parents, make sure that the kids are signed up for school, they're in the right grade, everything's going properly. But yeah, the county social worker can also double check with the school to make sure kids are attending.
How often do they double check with the school? Is that part of the actual process, or is that a... Oh, I think
in the youth, in our youth justice unit, they're checking every month for the older delinquent youth.
Okay.
Easily. For these, this really depends on the age of the kid, and you get a really good sense. If it's like a second grader and you're talking to the foster parent, you can see there's book bags and they're going and everything. We have a very good sense that they're in school. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a great question, though. That's a good, very good question. So what, where we go at, so during this part, all of this work is managed by the social worker. Parents are getting involved in therapy, maybe getting a psychological evaluation. Kids are getting treatment, therapy, birth to three services. If some of the kids have special needs, they're getting services for those special needs. We're supporting the foster parents through our model of care. And during this dialogue, during this year, year and a half, kids that have significant treatment needs sort of come up to the surface. Meaning the foster parents tell us the kids, you know, they really have anger issues or there's really problems in the foster home. And that's a dialogue between the foster parent and the social worker. And if we try to bring more services to bear, more therapy, more help for the child, and it's not successful, then we may need to look at moving a child to a higher level of care for more intensive treatment. And that's how a child welfare child would end up in treatment foster care, which those are foster parents that have higher level of training and there's more treatment provided. at the end of all this work, we're looking for this. We're looking for parents to have a safe home, physically safe, I'm talking about, that they have a source of income, that they're demonstrating they can manage their home, that they're beginning to demonstrate they can safely parent their children, they're making progress in whatever the mental health or addiction treatment issues that they're working on. And during this time, parents are getting, if they are making progress, they're getting more contact with their kids, and we're monitoring that. And now, when I said the order goes until they're 18, 19, what's happening at the same time as that all that other work is that every 6 months we're back in court, and the judge is reviewing our progress or lack of progress. And the judge, and we prepare what we call permanency plans, and the court reads, and there it's a plan for each child in a family's home. So if we have three kids in foster care, all with the same mom, there's three permanency plans. And each permanency plan would probably have, under the mother section, each plan would be very close to identical. What is the mom doing to improve her ability to be a safe parent? But under the child section of the permanency plan, the three may look very different because of the treatment needs for each child. And literally that is reviewed in court with the parents, with all those parties that we saw on the previous slide. And the judge then is giving comment, hopefully encouragement to the parents, or maybe admonishing them if they're not doing very well. And they're setting what they call permanency goals, a permanency hearing order, and they're letting the parent know that, you know, our goal now is for you to get your kids back through reunification, but if you're not making more progress in another 6 months, I may change this goal to adoption, or a concurrent goal to adoption and reunification. Yeah.
I don't know if I heard you right. You said there's a mom's section and then a child section?
Yeah, yes.
And father's section?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't hear
a parent section, yes.
Okay, so it is...
I misspoke. No, okay. It is both.
Okay.
Every child has a mother and a father, and yeah, we want both parents. No,
I know there's been a, you know, in the last 20 years, a whole father's rights movement.
No, I'm just misspeaking. Sure. I apologize for
that. Gotcha. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, I apologize. No, because we're always reaching out to both fathers, and it's not that unusual where kids are... maybe in a mother's home where the abuse occurred and a father has not been a very frequent contact with their kids, and once we get involved and we reach out to that dad and he gets involved and he didn't quite realize things weren't going that well in the mother's home, they step up and become a great resource. And that's still considered a reunification at the end, that if those kids end up getting returned permanently to that dad. Yeah. So yes, we do that all the time.
Yeah, that's actually where it was stemming from my question earlier about a situation I'm aware of is a father wasn't aware of what was going on in a mother's house. They don't live together. And come to find out, mom wasn't sending kids to school.
Right.
Was lying to the courts. And now he has to call the school every day to see if they're in school. And if they're not, he then has to call the cops. And
right.
The adult truancy process going. So, all right, thanks.
Yep. So what happens is...
Supervisor Rodriguez has a question.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Are these plans, I would assume these permanency plans aren't conducted then if the court's already gone through and terminated parental rights. Is that correct?
What's that?
A permanency plan isn't conducted then if TPR has already been conducted and the court's...
Yeah, we're not up to TPR yet, though. In the case scenario I'm giving an example of right now, we're still actively working with these kids, and so they're... By law, there has to be a permanency plan for any kid placed in out-of-home care.
Now, is this done? I'm sure, you know, if you know, your team takes children out of a home, and then from that point on, the parent or parents have said, okay, we're done. They want nothing to do with the children. I don't know how often that happens, but if that happens, is a permanency plan still done?
Yes.
The idea of, you know, that the parents are welcome to come back 6 months from now, or is it so they are still done?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a little confusing. Per state law, federal guidance, federal rules, every child in a court ordered placement in out of home care has to have a permanency plan every 6 months. It can be reviewed It has to be reviewed at a minimum once a year in court. The other 6 months, it could be done by a panel. Our judges made the leap, I don't know, 8-10 years ago. They said, we're going to review every permanency plan in court. They wanted, they took that extra work on, so they doubled the amount of permanency plans they were hearing, because they wanted to keep a close monitoring on how these kids are doing in foster care. So I really admire them for that. That was under, I think, Judge Rozelle and Judge Kirkman at the time. They were both in the juvenile court. So they opted to do that. And every judge after that has continued that practice. If parents make progress, and by making progress, that means that they're demonstrating that they're safe, that they did all those things that I talked about earlier, they're making real progress. We petition the court, we submit a change of placement request to the court, requesting the kids be returned home. Everybody, all those other parties, the guardian ad litem, everyone is going to weigh in on that decision in court. The judge finally makes a decision. If they agree, the judge generally orders the children back with the parent. They order what they call a 12-month order of conditions of continued placement in the parent's home. And we're not done with the case. We don't just say we don't walk away. We stay and monitor the case, generally 9 to 12 months after they return home. And during that time, we're still working with those parents, we're still providing services, and we're still monitoring safety. So these families that are in the child welfare system can be in this system when you add the 12 months that the kids are home, easily well over 2 years. You know, 2.5-3 years is not uncommon. Actually, you know, a year and a half with kids in care, another 12 months once the kids return home. And so the workers know these parents, and they really are pulling for them. And we're doing all this so the kids can live a safe life. And then what I'm very proud of in Kenosha is generally parents who go through this process in Kenosha rarely are involved in the child welfare system again. I'm not saying that 100% of the time, but we have a very high percentage that don't come back in. Yeah. The other process, if we terminate parental rights, that's another whole court process, and that's when parents are not making progress. We then have to, we submit a request to our district attorney's office laying out the lack of progress. Our district attorney drafts a petition. That sets another whole series of court actions in motion to terminate parental rights. That in and of itself can take 4 to 6 months of court hearings. And then at the end of the day, if parental rights are terminated, that child transfers to the state of Wisconsin. He or she gets a new caseworker for a few months, and that new caseworker from the state of Wisconsin finalizes the adoption. And it's another court hearing for the child to be adopted. And most kids that are adopted in Wisconsin in the child welfare system are adopted by the foster parents or relatives who have been caring for the kids during this whole period and who really fell in love with the kids and opened up their homes to them. So that's how kids in the child welfare system come into care, and that's how the courts have a big say in this, because when kids go into higher levels of care, then it's the court that is going to review how those kids are doing in those higher levels of care, whether they're making enough progress in those levels of care, whether they should stay in that higher level of care, or whether they can move to a more like a regular foster home again. Yeah. So really, it's all overseen very tightly by the courts, by judges. Yeah. Any other questions about the child welfare side of things?
I see on the end of that first column, all services for parents must continue. As we're going through the TPR process, or do those services continue after a judge has granted the TPR?
That's a great question. While the parents are still the parents, all the services we should be providing for them need to continue. And then once their parental rights are terminated, And again, that's a minority of our cases. You know, we have, you know, 70% of the cases are reunified safely. You know, but that group that does, we do terminate parental rights, then once their rights are terminated, literally, they're done. The parent's case closes, the child transfers to a state caseworker, and they then prepare everything legally for that child to be adopted.
Now, could, say we a TPR has been concluded, that the parent or parents have lost the rights to their children, this could be something that never occurs, but say that's done, and a substantial amount of time goes by, maybe the child was very young when this happened, and that parent or parents have changed their life in the years following that, could they petition the court for placement
No.
in the future? I mean, once TPR is done, you're done, you're never ever getting those children again.
Yes.
Okay.
Because the kids are being adopted.
Okay.
Yeah, so once the adoption is like having your own child, you know?
Right. No, I understand that.
I mean, but the adoptive parents, once they adopt them, they are...
It's their children.
It's their child.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then a question going back several slides, and you don't have to go back, I just took a note of it. What age are the older children getting a public defender versus a GAL, and why the difference in those?
Yeah, I'm sure Supervisor Celebrate can explain, but it's age 12 and up.
Okay.
So age 12 and up, they get a public defender who is representing their interests, what the child is expressing, they want. Under 11 and under, it's a guardian ad litem. So they are like an adult. They are an adult, right?
Right.
They're an attorney. They're looking out for the best interest for the younger child. So the premise under the law is that the age 11 and younger, they're not able to really express for themselves what's in their best interest. So think of like a four-year-old, right? How are they going to be able to weigh in on what's really best for them? Probably not. So the guardian ad litem is... their role is to look up what's in the best interest for that child.
So 12, if I'm doing my math correct, that would be middle school then, correct? The child's...
Yeah, or a seventh grader.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good bet, seventh grader. Yeah.
All right. That's all I have. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Those are great questions. Thank you.
Yep. How many children did you actually place for adoption last year alone?
We completed termination of parental rights on... 58 children last year.
That's just Kenosha County.
That's just in Kenosha County. So not all those kids were adopted last year. So by the end of December of 2020, 58 children had their termination of parental rights completed, and some of those were adopted that in 2020. Some will be adopted and have been adopted like the beginning of this year. Some will still be adopted later this year.
Okay,
yeah, because there's that lag. Yeah,
I'd just like to point out they all have an adopted resource, though. So we are not doing TPRs, termination of parental right cases, where we don't have an adopted resource for a child, because we don't want to create a legal orphan. That serves no value or purpose for that kid's life moving forward. So
absolutely, yeah. No, thank you, John. That's a great thing to remember. We work very well with the district attorney's office, and we proceed with the termination of parental rights when we know we have an adoptive resource. So that's best for the kids. Yeah.
Do we keep track of private organizations that conduct adoptions that may occur where the adopting family is in Kenosha County?
No, we don't. The Division of Children and Family Services doesn't.
Okay.
Sometimes those families come to our attention because they're looking for help with some of their adopted children, and we have a whole set of services through our Families First program that are voluntary that can help any family, and we've had adoptive families use those, but we don't track that. The private adoptions are just that, they're private.
Okay, and then... another question I have here. Do we keep statistics on what some of these major factors leading to the abuse of a child is? You know, I mean, do we know of the cases that we're involved with, you know, X amount of parents have issues due to alcohol, drug abuse, mental health issues? I mean, do we have a general scope or an idea?
I didn't bring those statistics with me. We have definitely statistics every year about how many kids come into the system for physical abuse versus physical neglect versus sexual abuse, those three broad categories. And then we don't have numerical hard data on what you're sharing, but what I can tell you from doing the work is addiction and untreated mental health issues are real drivers of most of that.
Okay.
Neglect is often related to addiction and something else.
And what would be the difference then? I have some ideas that come to my mind, but what would be the difference between abuse and neglect in your eyes and the eyes
sure,
of your team?
That's great, yeah. So abuse is, think of it more like a physical injury of some form. So let's take sexual abuse off the table. Let's talk about a significant bruising, injury, cuts, lacerations, breaking of bones, severe beating with a belt, objects, things like that, leaving real definitive marks. That's physical abuse. Neglect could be anything from I leave the house tonight, I'm a single dad, I have a little toddler, and I go to the bar tonight, and I leave my toddler home alone for 4 hours. That's neglect. But otherwise the toddler is well fed, but tonight I just left them alone. That's an incident of neglect. Neglect could be long-standing. I don't feed my child correctly. I don't take them to the doctor. Medical neglect. They have an illness or some sort of issue that needs medical attention. I never follow through. I never do it. Other types of neglect is just a dirty, filthy home that is literally unsafe for little babies or toddlers to live in. That would be neglect. Yeah.
And going back to medical care for children, I think we've probably all read in the past throughout the country where a child needs medical attention or treatment for a disease or an ailment of some sort, and the parents use the guise of religion to prevent treatment. Has that happened in Kenosha County, and what would...
Oh, gosh.
Would that go to a judge to decide then?
It would be up to a judge. I mean, that's a great question, too. That I don't know if that's happened any time in the last 10 years at all, for sure. I'm sure it hasn't in the last 12 years. I would remember that. But it would be up to, what would happen is through this legal process I'm talking about, we'd present all the information to the courts and say, we think this child's being neglected, they're not getting proper medical care. And maybe they get an attorney, the parents do, and they say, no, it's, we're practicing our religious faith. A judge will ultimately make that decision. And they can't even request a jury trial. That very rarely happens, but it could happen. But really what's happening is that the judge is deciding that these are kids that have been abused or neglected and they need services. And so what I always tell people is we investigate a lot of child abuse in a year's time. On average, we probably, like in 2019, we did 805 investigations. 90 families out of the 805 were brought into the formal system through this process. The other families, there was no abuse or neglect at that time. We may have offered help, supportive services, but they didn't need the formal support of the court. So it isn't that abuse. So when we get to this case, these families that are in court, they need to be in court. I'm very convinced of that. You know, that support is needed. But it's not every family we come in contact with by any means.
These are all really great questions. I would just say, can we hold them, maybe your questions till the end, so you can get all the way through
sure.
the presentation, because it's lengthy.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Well, we'll go through fast now. I'll try to pick
this up. No, I mean, this is all very, very important, and I don't want to lose momentum, but I want to make sure everybody's questions are answered too. So I just ask that we wait until the end of the presentation.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'll shift gears, and this will be a little faster. I'm going to talk a little bit about delinquent youth and the difference in how they come into care, because we work with those kids as well. We also work with kids that are truanting school, but I just really focus on the delinquency. So think of it this way. A kid is doing something that if you or I did it in the community, they'd be considered a crime. It's an alleged delinquent act. Local law enforcement's investigating. They send their investigation to juvenile court intake services, the district attorney's office. That group looks at what that alleged act is. Most kids are not arrested and placed in detention that are delinquent youth. Only about 10% come in the system that way. most are, they've done something that's illegal, okay, delinquent. They determine whether or not it's severe enough that it needs to go into court or if it could be handled as a deferred prosecution agreement. If they determine it should go to court, they then start a court process. The parents come to the hearings with their youth. The kid is given a public defender. The victim can tell the court their side of what happened, how they were victimized. At the end of that process, the court determines that a youth has committed a crime, but they call that a delinquency or delinquent act, and they're adjudicated delinquent. And that's because juvenile records are confidential, and they're sealed in a sense. They don't go on to impact an adult's life. So what happens then? Well, this is where we're going to just take a second. The whole juvenile justice system is under a different part of Wisconsin statute. It's the Juvenile Justice Code. It has three key components. It's there to protect the community, impose accountability for violations of the law, and equips juvenile offenders with competencies to live responsibly and productively. So there is part of this statute that is saying kids shouldn't do this again. We have to keep our community safe. They need to learn skills so they don't do this again. But they need to, there needs to be some accountability for their if they've broken the law, committed a delinquent act. We assign a social worker. The social worker interviews the child, the parents, gathers information about the delinquent act, checks on the school records of the kid. There's a hearing, a dispositional court hearing. The assistant district attorney, a public defender for the child, the youth parents, the social worker are there. Everyone's there to make recommendations of what this young person should do, what services they need to be working on. The court generally keeps these kids at home. They order an order of supervision for 9 to 12 months, and they order the kid to work to do all the services. The kid, the social worker then is setting up the services, monitoring school attendance, monitoring how they're behaving at home. If the kid needs therapy, they're getting therapy for that youth. They're getting other services the child needs. If family therapy is needed for the parents and the youth, we even have a family therapy program. We have a very intensive program with kids who are at high risk of reoffending called our Intensive Supervision Youth Competency Program, which can literally monitor a youth daily, face-to-face, 7 days a week, if we need to do that, where they're at that high risk of maybe reoffending. If things are going well, we make adjustments to the treatment plan. We keep these programs going forward. Overall, the youth is participating in services, making progress. Their youth is not reoffending. The youth is attending school. Their attendance is improving. They complete the year of supervision, and the case closes. And in Kenosha in 2019, and I don't have the numbers yet for 2020, but this is the stat from 19, 78% of delinquent youth on supervision don't recidivate while on supervision. They don't commit a new crime. So that's a great statistic. So you have 100 kids on supervision, 80 of them don't commit a new crime, roughly, 78. Now, what happens if it doesn't work that way, right? If the kids are really, what about these other 22% that we're struggling with? Well, that's where maybe the kid's not participating in services, maybe they commit a new delinquent act. Somebody is going to bring that case back to court in front of the judge. The judge is then going to respond to those escalating problems by ordering some sort of consequences, maybe sanctions. And this is often where delinquent youth end up in care. Because if kids are being given treatment services in the community and they're still acting out and there's still behavior issues, the court often at this time may say, I want this child to be in a different setting where they get more intensive treatment. The courts really are using more group homes for that for delinquent youth. They may use treatment foster care. If kids have significant mental health issues, they may use residential care centers. The last two alternatives are just for delinquent youth, These are locked facilities, alternatives to corrections through education, which is housed in the Racine Detention Facility, and then juvenile corrections, which is in Lincoln Hills, our Copper Lake School for Girls in Irma, Wisconsin. That is rare that kids ever go to these two settings first. It is more often what happens is kids, we've tried many different things, and then kids continue to have struggles. And then what happens then is if the youth is in out-of-home care, we continue to work with that youth. We have a program that works closely with the facility called our Intensive Aftercare Program and the county social worker. And within the first week they're in care, we're already talking about what are the treatment plans, what do we need to set up for discharge, how are they making progress. And we want to get the services in place so maybe after 4 or 5 months of treatment they can come back to the community with proper support and services and complete supervision. If the child makes progress in out-of-home care, we submit a change of placement, the court reviews that again, and the youth often is returned home and they complete their supervision at home. If things continue to go the other direction where the kid is not successful, then it's going to come back into court, and that's where often kids end up in settings like corrections. The other way kids end up in corrections, if they do an initial delinquent act, a crime that the court views as very serious and really poses a risk to people. And at the end of March of this year, which didn't show up in the monetary budget slide, we had a bunch of kids who stole cars, which is called operating motor vehicle without owner's consent. And we had some kids come in with gun offenses, which the courts in Kenosha take very, very seriously. So at the very end of March, a bunch more kids ended up in corrections, just all within the last 2 weeks of the month. So, but again, the judge looked at all those facts and said, this is unsafe. And so they went back to, that's the different side of this. The judges looked at those facts and focused a lot more on protecting the community from any future delinquent acts and imposing accountability for violations of law. And so they opted that way. And that's the judge's prerogative. So that is just to give you in a nutshell, but I'm sorry, I'm pretty long-winded. I apologize for that. But I think when we talk about kids and numbers and budgets, it's good to get back to why are kids in care? What's the reason for it? And the reason for it is to help kids, help them learn better decision-making, help them with problems that they're having so that they can become better citizens and not reoffend and not get in trouble again and not end up in adult prison. And most of our juvenile youth in delinquency don't go to prison, don't end up in the adult system. But there's always a subset that will. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I think we needed this education. I know I did. And I appreciate all the time and effort put into the slide and really encapsulating it and make it easy for me to understand. So I really appreciate it. I'll open it up to any questions.
Okay.
Supervisor Berg.
Question for you. In the county, we've tracked a lot of stuff like shots fired, opioid abuse, where we deployed services for opioid abuse. Do we track not, and I know individuals' houses and addresses are not what I'm asking for, but say hypothetically, in my district, I had X amount, and in this district, had X amount. Do we track at all regional areas where there's a higher propensity for determinations, children are not safe at home, or anything?
We don't really track. I mean, I know what you're talking about. It's like a heat map or something where you would pinpoint it. We don't have it historically tracked it that way. I mean, you can say that. Generally, more of the families we work with are in the city of Kenosha than the outlying areas of the county. That's a fair statement, but we don't track neighborhoods per se.
So I ask because I'd like to know if it's a if my district has a higher number, maybe that's where I need to deploy my resources and, okay. and get stacks of pamphlets or whatnot to bring out to my district and bridge, not even just lay them at people's doors. You know, I've done that in the past for other situations. And I think it's kind of be pertinent for future chairman or chairpersons of the board. That would be a good placement of supervisors to be on, say, human services if there's a higher propensity. Well, that's something that needs to be worked on, right? So that supervisor should have a responsibility to that district to find try to fix that situation. So that might be a better placement versus somebody where it almost never happens or other situations, you know, within human services. But
I think if we were to do something, we would do it as a whole. The one thing we don't want to be doing is, and I don't want to use the word profiling, but we don't want to make it seem that we are paying closer attention to one area versus another. So I would just say we have to be very cautious in how we roll something out and make sure that it's going to all of county residents and my view, not just be selective. We've got to make sure that we're doing things where we're not profiling.
I understand it, but we still can't be complacent about what's going on in my district. I don't know how many, you know, a lot of situations are happening in my district. How do I know this? You know, if I don't know, I'm not helping. I just said there's things that I can do. I can absolutely go door to door and drop pamphlets. Maybe the residents of my district aren't aware of all the services that we provide. I don't think it's profiling at all. But
no, I didn't want to use that word, but you get the gist of what I'm saying is that we need to make sure that we're being inclusive of the whole county and not to districts.
I'm not saying taking resources away from districts, but you know, take my situation of being in Afghanistan, for instance. We had the North region, and we broke that up into three regions. If we had more IEDs and soldiers dying in this area, we didn't keep the resources equal amongst everywhere. We deployed resources more so to where people were dying. And I think that's the situation here where these are children. If we're being complacent and we're not tracking it and we don't know them, hey, you know what? There's something here there. You know, maybe we need to deploy resources more to this area, not to take away from other portions of the county.
No, I'm not saying that.
But
I'm saying we need to be careful. Supervisor Palmaville?
Yeah. So, I mean, it happens everywhere. It happens out in the western part, and the domestic violence happens out in the western part, and the homelessness.
Right.
It's all happening everywhere. And so when you focus too much on one thing in one area, it does become problematic, and I think it's more on a county, as in John Jansen's responsibility to do that outreach to communities to do that. That's my sense of how it works and how you could do it more equitably without assuming, or like you said, it's not profiling, but
yeah.
It doesn't feel quite right to do it in that way.
Any other questions or comments?
Supervisor Beth. On your last file, you said 78% of the youth that were in serious trouble didn't need any further treatment while they were under supervision. After the supervision ended, is there an increase in their delinquent youth behavior?
We've tracked that using CCAP data, like the adult CCAP data. We've seen a little bit, but we've had numbers as like, you know, 71% still didn't commit another crime.
Really,
yeah.
Good with the support they've got.
Yeah. So I mean, it didn't stay at the high 78%, but it was very good still. Yeah. You know, it's very labor intensive to do that, to track it like so many years out. And it's you know, some people move kids, but a lot of the young people do stay in the community. So that's how you check that. I mean, literally, you have to look name by name and see if it matches in the adult records, in the adult circuit court access. Yeah.
Yeah.
Supervisor Rodriguez.
Thank you. I know over the years I've tried to educate myself as much as I can with your department. I know at times it's been contentious, but one thing I do want to note in recent history is, I'm sure everybody's aware, several months ago, very tragically, there was a murder in my district where a mother lost her life. The children were at home when it happened. And it was something that, talking with the neighbors, I went out there that night, and then the following days thereafter, talking with the neighbors, one family did note that, as tragic as that incident was, it was something that domestic abuse had been happening there for quite some time. And it wasn't that it never got sent to your department, but it was that, as we often see, or we too often see, battered woman syndrome is very real, and it's something that the police department tried to do what they could, but there's only so much you can do to a certain extent. But with that, these parents had told me that the night that this murder occurred, the children had actually left the home when the parents started arguing and went across the street and to play with those children and kind of seek a safe refuge. And it was something that it was difficult for me to stand there and talk with this mother, because I could see the pain in her eyes when you know, the police converge on the neighborhood and they see something so horrific and so graphic. But it was something she asked me was, you know, here's my contact info. Can you reach out to DCFS? And I'd love for those children who were then immediately taken by DCFS to have some sort of normalcy in this very troubling time. And if I can arrange something where the kids can connect, she wants to set that up. And so I want to thank Ron and your team. I called. I don't remember who I spoke with, but I spoke with a social worker. Because of the laws governing your department, a lot of confidentiality. She said she couldn't share many things with me, which I understood. But I did follow up with that parent, and she said that DCFS did reach out to her, and they did get those kids connected. And it gave these very young school-aged children some sense of normalcy in such a trying time. And further on that, I want to thank Kathy as well. I know you and I spoke, I think, the following day. It's something that I spoke with county staff. I spoke with crisis workers. They got me, in less than an hour's notice, a huge folder of resources. I mean, magnets, calendars, pamphlets, stickers, all sorts of things that I was then able to go out to that neighborhood and knock on the doors and speak with those residents. And it's a lot of things that even those of us on the county board were not quite sure. We don't know quite how far reaching our resources go. And it was something that I was able to convey to these residents that, you know, if you and your children or your neighbors are struggling with what happened here yesterday, and whether you want to talk to somebody or your children want to talk to somebody now or even in the future or down the road, something totally unrelated, these resources are here for you. So I do want to thank your team, Kathy. I want to thank you as well. And I want to thank the team over at Crisis, because on a moment's notice, that's something that your team of Crisis and so many, you know, veteran services, I'm sure the Sheriff's Department could go on and on. But it's very real when it happens in your district. Yeah. And it's very real when it happens, in my instance, not far from where I call home, you know, where I live, and not far from the school that I grew up attending when something like this happens. So I just wanted to note that. And in that instance, I was incredibly happy to hear that DCFS was able to reach out with that family and get those kids not only somewhere safe — those children were placed with, I believe, family after that event — but somewhere safe and somewhere, you know, that they were able to connect with other children that they know, love, and feel safe around. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
So, in my mind, there's kind of a continuum of treatment facilities, where the regular foster care, you can accommodate a lot of kids without a, you know, less specialized needs. At the other end, you have the outlier, like the case we spoke about.
Right.
In the middle, where do we lack capacity? Because it seems like some of the times when we speak about the cost, that cost is related to the fact that either maybe within the entire state there is a deficit of care, or obviously if it's very specialized, maybe it has to go out of state. But for those middle ones, like the group homes, residential care, where do we locally probably lack the capacity to handle the need?
There aren't as many very good group homes in Wisconsin, so we're looking for group homes that are better. We have one that we use quite a bit in Wittenberg, Wisconsin, that's very good. There are not enough treatment foster homes for kids, meaning there were kids that used to be able to go to treatment foster care 10 years ago, and the capacity in that area has shrunk. Those are private agencies, treatment foster home agencies, group homes. Those are private, you know, it's like a business. I'm decided to run a group home. So it really has to be our entrepreneurs willing to go into that line of work and create those resources. We have, so it's not something that we fund, we don't create it here. A private agency, not for profit, does that. Residential care centers, there are less of those in Wisconsin than there were 10 years ago. A number have closed down. They've just decided to get out of that business, so to speak. So it's really in all three of those areas. Wisconsin could use more resources in all three. Yeah.
Any other questions? Ron and Tammy, thank you very much for presenting this to us this evening, and I look forward to seeing it again at Finance. Please keep us up to date on how the child is doing in New Jersey, not for the cost, but to understand really how he's doing and progressing. So okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for taking time out of your busy evening to listen to the presentation. I appreciate it. Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is the Kenosha County Racial Equity Workgroup update by Supervisor Gully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the resolution to create the Kenosha County Racial Equity Commission passed the legislative committee last Tuesday? Executive committee meeting. And it will be on the agenda for the next full board meeting, which is, I believe, the 18th. The resolution as it was amended in the executive committee was distributed to the members of the executive committee today. I have not had a chance to distribute out to the members of the work group yet. I will do that shortly. That would be my update.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? Okay. Is there any other business as authorized by law? Seeing none. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Supervisor Berg and Celebrate seconded. All in favor?